Hello and welcome to the Master of Demon Gorge podcast. Today we're talking about Troubled Empire, a book review. I recently read The Troubled Empire, China in the Yuan and Ming Dynasties by Timothy Brook, the Canadian sinologist based at the University of British Columbia. It's volume 5 of the Harvard University Press series, The History of Imperial China, for which Brook serves as the overall editor. And I started reading it actually because of the recent Storm in a Teacup controversy over whether Chinese dragons ought to be referred to as dragons. As you know, it's the year of the dragon, according to the Chinese zodiac. Around the time of Chinese New Year, however, it transpired that some in China were now saying that because Chinese dragons are different from Western dragons, and because Western dragons are generally a negative creature, while Chinese dragons are positive ones, we should stop saying dragons when referring to Chinese ones. We should simply use the Chinese word, long. Well, I personally feel that this is a controversy over nothing important, so I don't particularly care, and I don't really want to get into it. But because of the controversy, Professor Brook's Troubled Empire was somehow recommended to me, and I decided to read it. Hence this episode. A book review of sorts. Let's start with the positive. I learned a number of very interesting things from the book. First off, the reason the book was recommended to me in the first place. Dragons. Turns out, there have been many reported dragon sightings in the annals of Chinese history. Not least during the period covered by the book, the Yuan and Ming dynasties, i.e. from the late 13th through the mid-17th centuries. And the records of these appearances are somewhat surprising. Although, in Chinese culture, dragons are generally thought to be associated with water instead of fire, as in Europe, in some reports, even in China, they were seen to breathe fire. In addition, although we say that dragons are a good omen in Chinese culture, in the annals, the dragon sightings are often described as evil omens, worrying signs. Here's Brook translating and summarizing a section from Ming Shi, the official history of the Ming Dynasty. The first dragon to erupt into the Ming realm did so in 1404, the second year of the reign of the Yongle Emperor, reign 1403 to 1424. Several more were seen toward the end of this reign, the last unleashing an epidemic. As Yongle had come to the throne by usurping it from his nephew, who mysteriously died in a palace fire, people had good reason to suspect that heaven was chastising the man. Not that anyone dared say that, for it would be high treason to suggest that the emperor should not be the emperor. Everyone kept quiet, and after his death, the realm remained relatively dragon-free until the 1480s. It was during the reign of the Hongzhi Emperor, reigned 1488 to 1505, that dragons began to be spotted with some regularity. 5 of these sightings are noted in local sources, but just 2 found their way into the official history of the Ming Dynasty, Ming Shi, compiled and published in the 18th century. The first of the official sightings, dated July 14th, 1496, tells of a dragon that emerged from a soldier's scabbard during a lightning storm along the section of the Great Wall protecting Beijing. The second sighting, 9 years later, reports an apparition swirling in a gyre of wind above the Forbidden City, and then ascending into the sky at noon on June 8th, 1405. It looked like a man riding a dragon into the clouds, the historians reported. I also enjoyed Brooks' discussion of the climate and disease factors that shaped the course of the Yuan and Ming dynasties. We've covered these factors before. The course of the Han Dynasty tracks the rise and fall of the Roman Republic, then Empire, almost perfectly, and both follow the Earth's climate patterns. And the fall of the Ming Dynasty in 1644 can be substantially attributed to the Little Ice Age. It's not for nothing that the fall of the Ming coincided almost exactly with the 30 Years' War in Europe, which ended with the Peace of Westphalia in 1648. So Brooks systematically goes through the climate and epidemic patterns of the Yuan and Ming dynasties, establishing 9 periods of downturn, which he calls the 9 sloughs, S-L-O-U-G-H, slough, meaning a low point, a quagmire. Explaining history through climate is, of course, very popular now, and that's a reflection of our own climate anxieties. But I find climate explanations of history nonetheless interesting and convincing. Brooke has a discussion on Mandarin, the language, or official speech as it was known to the Chinese. On page 152, he writes, "Students were required to learn official speech in their home schools, an artificial pronunciation that Europeans called Mandarin, following the Portuguese adaptation of the Hindu word mantra, Sanskrit mantrim, meaning counselor." This was interesting to me, because I had thought the etymology of the English word Mandarin was Mandarin, Manchu grandee, i.e. Mandarin was the language spoken by Manchu court officials during the Qing dynasty. But of course, here we're dealing with the Ming dynasty before there were any Manchu grandees. If the Portuguese already started to refer to the language of the Ming court as Mandarin, then this etymology from Sanskrit is surely more plausible. Brooks' discussion also reminds me of the episode we've already done on the nature of Mandarin. In that earlier episode, I talked about the 1728 edict of Emperor Yongzheng, complaining that officials from the southern provinces of Fujian and Guangdong spoke Mandarin so badly that he couldn't understand a word they said. Well, turns out they already had this problem during the Ming. Here's Brooke. In 1527, before he became Minister of Rights, Huo Tao, who was from Guangdong, was excused from his duty as court lecturer to the Jiajing Emperor on the grounds that he was a southerner and his speech was full of incomprehensible words. This failing was not enough to cripple a career, but it was enough for teasing someone who, like Huo Tao, famously lacked a sense of humor. Fujian accents were judged to be even more incomprehensible. 2 Fujianese served as grand secretaries in the 1430s. But according to the history of the Ming, their speech was so hard to understand that 200 years passed before an emperor appointed anyone from Fujian to the Grand Secretariat again. Just to be clear, Fujian is where they speak Hokkien, and Hokkien is nowadays also called Taiwanese. And that, boys and girls, is why we teach Mandarin in schools. I also learned from Brooke the reason our modern word for province, sheng, is different from the word used in ancient China, zhou. The latter makes more sense, as it directly translates to land. In fact, modern American states are still called zhou in Chinese. Niuyue Zhou is New York State. Sheng on the other hand, actually means secretariat or department. The character is still the kanji used in Japanese for ministry, as in Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And in ancient China, Zhongshusheng, or Central Secretariat, or Grand Secretariat, was the chief executive organ through which the emperor ruled the empire. It was basically the prime minister's office. The Mongols, during the Yuan Dynasty, however, called the area around Beijing Zhongshusheng, Central Secretariat, because this was the area directly governed by the central government, just as Washington, D.C. comes directly under Congress and not any state government. The Mongols then divided the rest of China into 8 branch secretariats, effectively provinces, but using the word secretariat, sheng. After the Ming overthrew the Mongols, they modified the Yuan division of provinces, but kept using this same character, sheng. And so now, several centuries later, in modern Chinese, the character means province. Relatedly, Brook discusses the rise of Ming autocracy through the abolition of the Zhongshusheng, the central secretariat. The idea is that the Ming retained certain Mongol Yuan practices, which explain its later institutional sclerosis. After the 1380 Hu Weiyong case, in which Zhu Yuanzhang, or the Hongwu Emperor, the founder of the Ming, accused his chancellor of plotting against him, the emperor abolished the central secretariat and the chancellorship. The Ming thereafter hobbled along without a chancellor or prime minister, until the obvious problem of having the emperor directly rule over the 6 ministries became too significant. The Hongwu Emperor was a micromanager, but certainly not all of his successors were or wanted to be. Hongwu's immediate successor, Emperor Jianwen, raised the office of the imperial secretary to a kind of cabinet. Then Emperor Yongle overthrew Jianwen and became emperor, and he raised the leader of the cabinet to a de facto prime minister or chancellor. All right, so all of this is very interesting, and I learned a lot. But I'm sorry to say, I also found some errors in the book, and arguments I would quibble with. Some errors are very minor, admittedly. Brook at one point measures grain output by the traditional Chinese measure, dan, except he mispronounces it as shi. It's understandable. The character is actually usually pronounced shi, and it's the same character we use to mean stone or rock. But everyone who grew up with a Chinese education knows that when used as a unit of measurement, rather than meaning stone, the character is pronounced as dan. A second misreading is less minor. Like I said, Emperor Yongle overthrew Emperor Jianwen to replace him. This took place between 1399 and 1402. And the civil war, this civil war, is called Jingnan Zhiyi, or the War of Pacifying Troubles. It took this name because under rules set up by the Ming founder, Emperor Hongwu, the princes in their fiefdoms, which Yongle was one before the war, were authorized to come to the central government with their armies to pacify troubles if the emperor were somehow besieged. Yongle claimed that this was what he was doing, even though, of course, in reality, he was the one besieging the emperor. In any event, Professor Brook misreads Jingnan to pacify the troubles as Jingnan to pacify the south. So he calls Yongle's war the campaign to pacify the south. That is just wrong. As for the opening discussion on dragon sightings, it's fascinating. But on page 21, Brooke claims, China's last dragon was spotted over coastal waters in November 1905, just a few years before the fall of China's last empire, the Qing. And his citation is to page 1519 of the Qing Shi Gao, the draft history of the Qing dynasty. Reader, I checked page 1519 of the draft history of the Qing dynasty. The last reported dragon sighting mentioned on this page took place in 1895, not 1905. And there's no mention of coastal waters. I still don't understand where he got that from. Finally, I would challenge somewhat Brooke's portrayal of Ming autocracy and the problems that it raised. It seems to me that many of these issues had precedents in Chinese history. They were far from novel problems created by and during the Ming. We already mentioned Emperor Yongle overthrowing his nephew, Emperor Jianwen, in the Jingnan campaign. At this time, there was a top official in Emperor Jianwen's government called Fang Xiaoru. The new emperor, Yongle, tried to get Fang Xiaoru to come over to his side. Fang Xiaoru refused in no uncertain terms. Outraged, Emperor Yongle had him killed. And not just him, but every member of his family that he could track down. Every student, every friend, every associate. All told, Emperor Yongle's executioners killed 873 people. Fang Xiaoru and 872 others connected to him in some way or another. Brooke calls what Fang Xiaoru faced the predicament of loyalty. What do you do as a Confucian gentleman if you've committed your loyalty to one lord, one regime, but another one takes over and demands that you switch allegiance? But Brooke talks about this like it's a new phenomenon resulting from Ming autocracy. In fact, it's far from new. The Chinese have wrestled with the problem since their early history. When the Zhou dynasty overthrew the Shang in 1046 BC, two men named Bo Yi and Shu Qi chose to remain loyal to the fallen Shang. They famously refused to eat the grains of the Zhou, and so went into the mountains to live as hermits, divorced from the rest of society and economy. To refuse to eat the grains of Zhou remains a common phrase in Chinese and an important Confucian teaching. After the Ming dynasty fell in 1644, many former Ming officials and members of the literati refused to work with the new Qing dynasty, preferring to refuse to eat the grains of Zhou. On the other hand, the diametrically opposite position is also a part of Chinese canonical thought. The observation, 识时务者为俊杰, translates as, those who understand which way things are going are the heroes. It first appeared in the Chronicles of the Three Kingdoms, the history text written in the late 3rd century AD. And it's come to be used as a refrain to convince members of the losing side in a political struggle to switch to the side of the winners, rather than to persist in a hopeless cause. Another saying, repeated in Romance of the Three Kingdoms and Investiture of the Gods, is 良禽择木而栖,贤臣择主而食. The superior bird is picky about which tree to land on, so the superior minister chooses carefully which lord to serve. It may be instructive that these are historical novels written during the Ming, but the point stands. there were already celebrated precedents of a minister switching sides once it became clear that the other lord was the more moral or capable contender, or that the will of heaven was with him. Guan Zhong, during the spring and autumn period, is one example, and Wei Zheng, during the Tang Dynasty, also comes to mind. Brooke then talks about the constitutional crisis caused by Tumu Zhibian, the Tumu incident. What happened was, in 1449, Emperor Yingzong of Ming personally led an expedition against the Mongols northward from Beijing. It was a terrible idea, and he wound up getting captured. Back in the Forbidden City, the Ming court had to decide what to do. They could continue to consider Yingzong the emperor, but that would mean allowing Ming China to be blackmailed by the Mongols, who now had their emperor as a hostage. Or they could do the Chinese equivalent, the ancient Chinese equivalent, of invoking the 25th Amendment and declare Yingzong no longer emperor due to incapacity. They chose option B, declared Yingzong no more than a private citizen, and then chose Yingzong's half-brother to replace him as Emperor Daizong. The problem was that as long as Yingzong was alive, it was possible that he'd one day come back. And if he did, then what? Who would be emperor then? A popular ditty circulated around Beijing at this time, ostensibly about the rain. 雨滴雨滴成荒土地, 雨若再来泄了土地. Raindrop, raindrop, city god, earth god, if the rain comes back again, thank Earth God for bringing rain. But given the commonality of puns in Chinese, the song could be read as 雨滴雨滴成王土地,雨若再来泄了土地. Gave his brother land to the prince of Cheng. If the emperor comes back again, he'll have to hand it back again. 8 years later, Emperor Yingzong really did come back. He kicked his brother off the throne and probably had him killed. Again, this was undoubtedly a dramatic episode in Ming history, but Book writes about it without much of a sense that precedents already occurred in Chinese history. At the end of the Northern Song Dynasty, the Jurchen Jing Empire attacked Song China from the north. Emperor Huizong of Song, finding himself unable to handle the situation, abdicated in 1126 in favor of his son, who became Emperor Qingzong of Song. But Emperor Qingzong didn't know what to do either. So, by 1127, as part of the crisis called the Humiliation of Jingkang, the Jurchen army had taken both emperors, Qingzong and Huizong, prisoners. Meanwhile, some members of the Song imperial family and the court escaped to southern China. There, they reconstituted the court and declared the beginning of the Southern Song Dynasty. And they faced the same problem that the Ming court later faced. What to do when your emperor has been taken prisoner by the enemy? They did the same thing that the Ming later did. They rallied around another member of the imperial family and made him the new emperor. In this case, it was another son of Emperor Huizong, the younger brother of Emperor Qingzong, now declared Emperor Gaozong of Song. In the case of the Song Dynasty, the hostage emperor or empress never did return to challenge the new emperor. But brothers challenging each other and brothers succeeding each other also have many precedents in Chinese history. Book writes about it like it was a practice introduced by the Mongols, something he called tanistry, a term from Celtic practice but is also used to describe the Mongol and other steppe peoples' tradition of the ruling family's males challenging each other to identify the most capable among them. Emperor Taizong of the Tang was famously not his father's firstborn son. He fought and killed his brother in the so-called Xuanwu Gate incident to win his place as the crown prince. This was back in the early 7th century. And of course, Emperor Taizong went on to be one of the most celebrated emperors in Chinese history. Even back in the time of Qin Shi Huang, the first emperor, so the 3rd century BC, there was a moment when his younger brother was going to challenge him for the throne. Brooke goes on to write about the Guoben Zhizheng, or the foundation of the state crisis. It was called that because it had to do with the question of who should be the crown prince. The position of the crown prince was sometimes called the foundation of the state, meaning that he represented the dynasty's future. The crisis took place during the reign of Emperor Wanli of Ming. Wanli was the longest reigning emperor of the Ming dynasty, ruling from 1572 to 1620. He had a firstborn son, born in 1582, who by the rule of primogeniture ought to be the crown prince. But he had another son in 1586, born to his favorite concubine. And now the concubine wanted her son to step over his older brother and be named the crown prince. And the mandarins were upset about this because, of course, the correct custom would be to stick to the firstborn. Emperor Wanli wound up arguing with his courtiers about this for 15 years. Once again, Brooke writes about this episode like it was a distinctly Ming phenomenon. The Confucian tradition of primogeniture versus the idea introduced by the Mongols that a younger brother could step over his elder if he proved to be more capable. But again, a ruler wanting to name the son he had with his favorite consort rather than his firstborn is hardly new. Many of the Spring and Autumn and Warring States stories are born of this impulse, so much so that it almost feels repetitive when you read that period of history. It's a perennial problem. If a ruler dies when he is relatively young, then his son and heir is likely still a child. But if a ruler lives to middle age or older, his son and heir has grown to adulthood, but he almost invariably takes new and younger concubines, and one of them may well bear him a new son, and then ask him to name the new child as the heir, sidelining the adult son in favor of the infant, leading to constitutional crisis. For example, King Wuling of Zhao, the state of Zhao during the Warring States period. King Wuling did exactly that, replaced his firstborn with his younger son, born of his favorite concubine, as the crown prince. Then he abdicated so that the younger son was now king, and he was King Emeritus. In 295 BC, his displaced firstborn son launched a coup to take back what he saw was his. But the younger brother ended up defeating the older. The older son ran to his father, King Wuling, and sought his protection. The younger son ended up killing them both. King Wuling of Zhao, who had been a great king, wound up with a tragic ending. In any event, altogether, I would say that I learned some very interesting things from Brooke's book But I also found some mistakes, and his portrayal of the various crises of the Ming as peculiar to the nature of that dynasty strikes me as unconvincing. And so that is my book review of Professor Timothy Brooks' Troubled Empire. This has been MODG. Thank you for listening.